This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. Reese, our content agent, wrote the copy based on our best practices, like mentioning Monday.com 3 times. That was the second. Johnny, our coordination agent, built the timeline and kept everyone aligned. Olivia, our human creative director, stayed in the loop. Because agents are great, but they don't always know when a joke lands. She had one note: tell listeners it only takes minutes to build an agent. So, minutes. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CT&C 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hour number two, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. As we talked about last hour, in the first hour of the program, the return to play for the NHL. And we got into that. PGA Tour, golf, they've already been playing. They've already returned, and they've been playing. They just wrapped things up in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Webb Simpson took the RBC Heritage there in Harbortown. In fact, I've actually golfed at that course in the past, way a long time ago. Darren McFarland and Willie Donick. Now we say hello to Bob Herrick, who covers golf for ESPN and ESPN.com. Bob, how you doing?
Good. How are you guys today?
We're doing fantastic here in Nashville. Thanks for joining us. So two in the books and golf's return to play. How do you think it's gone thus far?
I think overall it's gone really well. I mean, obviously they had their first positive test last week, and fingers crossed that there aren't any more, because, you know, sometimes there's a lag time. It was inevitable, I suppose, you know, when you're dealing with so many people, that this was going to occur. But it's been a pretty monumental undertaking to get this back on track, to get golf back. You're not dealing with a team of players. You're dealing with, you know, 150 players and caddies every week. And sometimes it's different from week to week. So to pull this off so far has been pretty good. The golf's been good. It's been exciting. And, you know, they're pushing forward with their schedule. And, you know, I think it's been pretty impressive.
Well, in a lot of cases with the shutdown of all sports and everybody being quarantined, you know, we've talked about it with a lot of sports. Some sports it's easier than others to work when there was a shutdown. These are professional athletes. I have to believe golf is a little bit more on the easier side, because in some cases – some golf courses were still open, or at least they were open quicker than, you know, somebody looking for certainly a sheet of ice in hockey or in other sports. But how have the players talked about what they were able to do to stay sharp during when things went away in mid-March?
Yeah, you know, some of them lived in parts of the country where golf wasn't available to them. Certainly gyms, if they didn't have stuff at home, you know, a lot of guys put the clubs away. They just said, this isn't coming back anytime. I'm just going to not worry about it. But I think what you're seeing is, you know, they did announce the schedule, their proposed schedule, pretty much 2 months before they started. And about a month out is when they really dug down into the details of how it would work. And so these guys had time, you know, and even the places that were more restrictive were beginning to open to golf. And the ones that are doing well right now, I think, are the ones you see who were committed to the idea that I'm going to be ready to go when it starts. You know, some guys maybe not haven't been quite as much, and it's understandable, but there's been a pretty high level of play among these guys. And, you know, I think they would, you know, they pretty much the month before got into the idea of, I'm going to start getting back after it. And, you know, guys do take long stretches off when times are normal. And so, you know, depending on how they structure it, it might only take them 2 weeks to sort of get geared back up, you know. So I'm not surprised by the high level of play. You know, and the courses have also yielded a lot of low numbers too. Just the circumstances, I think, time of year and the types of courses that they've been playing just so happen to yield a lot of birdies. And so I think that combination is why we're at where we're at.
Yeah, I know in Hilton Head they had a lot of rain, softened things up in scores. You had to score really well. Is Daniel Berger one of those guys? He came back and he won in Fort Worth, Texas. I think he finished third in Hilton Head this weekend. So back-to-back weekends of Daniel Berger being right there at or near the top. Is he one of the guys you referenced that you think has taken advantage of the off time and come out playing really well?
Yeah, I think because he also, you know, he had been playing really well before all of this. You go back into last fall, he hadn't been over par since like October in the five or six events he had played. He was trending very well. And I think he sort of probably took the mindset of, look, I don't want to waste this. You know, I don't want to be letting this slip away. So he might have stayed a little bit more in touch with it. You know, he lives in Florida. Most of Florida was open pretty much the entire time. Certainly he would have been able to find a place to practice. And while I don't think he wanted to be grinding for that entire 3 months, I do think, you know, playing, practicing here and there, working, you know, playing casual golf during all that time helps. It's less ground to make up. And, you know, as you pointed out, he didn't miss a beat. You know, he came right back. He wins the first event in the playoff. He was right there again on Sunday. And he's got a nice run going.
Bob Herrick covers PGA for ESPN and ESPN.com. And we're all trying to figure out, no matter what line of work you're in, whether you're an athlete or anybody out there listening, what you do, workplaces may change through all this. There may be a new mindset through all of this. And you know, we will not maybe return to when this is all done, Bob, we may not return to what we had before everything shut down in mid-March. And we've talked about that with other sports. Is there anything that you can think of right now on the tour that when they come out of all this, they're going to say, you know what, we kind of actually liked this element, or this is something that could be good moving forward? I don't know if there's anything like that, but how would you answer that?
Well, I can certainly see that from our standpoint in the media, and I'm not necessarily saying I agree, but you know, right now, for obvious reasons, they're keeping us distanced from the players.
Sure.
And, you know, there's even if you're on site, the main interviews are done via, you know, via Zoom or some sort of video capability. And so even though, you know, the player might be in the next room or, you know, on site within a couple hundred yards, you're asking your questions via computer. You can see him, he can see you, but it's still different than being in the same room. And then the access to anybody else, which, you know, for us is typically, you can pretty much approach anybody after their round. You could go in the locker room, you can get some guys on the putting green or on the driving range. That is not allowed right now. So it severely limits the ability to work ahead on things, to work on stories that other people might not be working on. And, you know, unfortunately, I could see the tour keeping some of these limits in place because it probably makes things easier for them. But it doesn't make it easier for us, and that's, you know, that's something that's, it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. In terms of the actual golf, in terms of that, I mean, you know, there's some things they're doing, like with scorecards, where they're not having you exchange scorecards. You're just keeping your own score, and a walking score monitors it, and then it can be attested afterward. Those are sorts of things that seem common sense anyway, and whether, you know, whether or not there's really any danger in touching a card or not, that is something that could be eliminated. That is not... The idea of how we keep score in this day and age seems archaic, and it's possible that they could do something about that. But you know, the other stuff, you know, the attempts to distance on the course with caddies and other players, I've noticed they've probably not been as good about that as they could be, and I think those are some things going forward that they might want to work on in the short term. But once we go back to the other way, that'll all be gone. You know, they're not going to keep doing that. I, and that's understandable.
Talking to Bob Herrick, senior writer for ESPN.com, covering the PGA. We're talking a little golf here as they continue to move through. They've been playing, and they've got a tournament scheduled up in Connecticut for this week. So, Bob, let's back up for more of the casual fan that follows the golf majors more. What are they working towards? What are the key things? When are the majors? I know the PGA Championship is on the schedule, but so if you're a golfer and you're trying to do well in the majors, what are you working your way towards?
Yeah, the first major is the PGA Championship. It starts August the 6th, and they just announced yesterday they are going to go ahead at Harding Park in San Francisco. There had been some murmurings that they might try to move it, but they are going to stay there but play without spectators. You know, so we're going to have our first major, our first spectatorless major, and that's going to be odd. You know, a tournament so big and so important with nobody there. You know, that's actually sooner than you think. It's like 6 weeks away, you know. And so, like, I liken it to if it were normal times and we're kind of like at the end of February, early March with the Masters looming, you know, it'll be here before you know it. So the U.S. Open's been rescheduled for late September. So in that regard, you sort of have the distance between majors that we used to have when the Masters was first and the U.S. Open was second. You know, it was kind of like 8 weeks in there. And that's pretty close to what it's going to be for this. Obviously, the British Open was canceled. So we're not having that. They're just going to restart next year. And then the Masters have been rescheduled for November. So that's a big difference because that's a pretty big lag between the U.S. Open and the Masters. It's going to be odd for all this, but if they happen in this environment, I think that's the thing we should be focused on and be glad that we're going to get them. Yes. and hope that this thing doesn't get worse so that maybe the Masters and the U.S. Open can have spectators. The Memorial in a month is planning on having spectators, which is, you know, ambitious. You know, that's in Ohio, and it's ambitious given the climate and, you know, all these restrictions. But I think a lot of people are going to really be looking to that to see how that comes off and how it works and to see if that might be a blueprint for others to follow.
How much does golf rely on the gallery in terms of their financial model? We've talked about it with all the sports here in Nashville, for example. You know, the NHL certainly relies heavily on the fans for a big part of their revenue, whereas football does not as much because they have such giant TV contracts. What about golf?
Yeah, it's huge. Now, it doesn't impact the purse and how the players are paid, which is a lot different than the other sports. I realize the NFL, their salaries are pretty much covered by the TV rights. But when you see how baseball's haggling over this, you get the sense that those numbers coming in mean something. In golf, it's huge, but it's more to the operation of the event. The purses are paid for through a combination of the title sponsor and the TV contracts. So there's a formula that they use, like X number amount from the title goes to the purse, and X amount goes to the tour, and then from the TV, it's the same thing. And then the tour keeps a cut, which is how they run the tour. And so, you know, when they lost 13 weeks of tournament, that was a huge chunk of money that the PGA Tour lost, you know, not to mention the players not being able to play and the local tournaments not having charitable dollars coming in through ticket sales. But the ticket sales, the local corporate hospitality, the pro-am is huge. None of these events are having pro-ams so far. That is how these events operate. They don't really get money from the PGA Tour. They get maybe a small amount from the title sponsor. It's called an entitlement fee. It might get them through about 6 weeks of the year. I mean, the rest of it, you know, they have a tournament director. They might have a director of sales. They have an operations person. Then they have to pay for, you know, the setting up of grandstands and roping the course and, you know, all the amenities that come with golf tournament. And it runs into the millions, you know, and then, of course, they want to give their excess to charity. So to not be able to sell a single ticket, it's huge. I mean, these tournaments that are being played right now, I would guess, are probably operating at a loss. And they are relying on some help from the PGA Tour to make them right. So it's tough. I'm sort of curious to see if some of these events start bringing back a pro-am. You could do a pro-am with, instead of having 50 groups, maybe you have 30. Instead of having four amateurs in a group, maybe you have two or three. Have a pro and two or three amateurs. You raise the price. It'll be for people that, you know, obviously can afford it. But that's a huge revenue source. Most tournaments make $700,000 to $1 million just off their Wednesday pro-am. So if they could even bring that back, it would be big. And, you know, you think that, you know, you can play golf distance. We've known that since the beginning. So perhaps that could be done that way. But so far they've elected not to have pro-ams. And I think that might be the next step.
Good stuff. Bob, as we let you go, you wrote a nice piece on Brooks Koepka, of course, who slumped a little bit after being number one in the world, but he had a promising outing here recently. So give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, he had really struggled. He hadn't done anything since last August, and he mentioned it the other day. He said, you know, it's been 10 months since I've been in contention. I'm thinking to myself, yeah, wow, how about that? It has been. You know, I think we lose track of where we are in the calendar with all this. It's been since last August. And, you know, he had a knee issue. He aggravated it. He missed 3 months of time. Then he missed another 3 months like everybody. But his results in there were poor. I mean, he didn't have it. I don't think he had anything in the top 20. In March, he shot 81 in the third round, his career high at Bay Hill. You know, felt concerned enough to go see Butch Harmon in Las Vegas on the Monday of the Players. You know, so he went all the way out from Orlando, all the way out to Vegas, and came back for the Players. And then, of course, it got canceled after one round. So he sort of felt he might be turning the corner there. But I think you have to believe that the time off helped. You know, it allowed him to get that knee better, to strengthen it. He's been able to work on his game and practice. And, you know, we saw a pretty good effort there this past weekend. His first top 10 since last August when he was fourth, he finished seventh. So, you know, maybe that's what he needed. And this week at the Travelers, that's probably a good event for him. It'd be interesting to see if he's able to follow up on it and keep it going.
Thanks for the visit, as always. Continue to be safe, and hopefully one day we'll be talking to you about a PGA stop here in our fine city in Nashville. We keep our fingers
crossed. That would be great.
Bob, thanks for the visit, as always.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That is Bob Herrick, senior writer, golf writer for ESPN.com, and we do appreciate him joining us. We will come back. More of Darren Donick and Chase next. Pecker and Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5, the game on this Tuesday morning. RockNashville.com is your community resource page. Check it out for information around town, including Nashville's Good to Go initiatives, CDC updates, ways to donate to Second Harvest Food Bank of Middle Tennessee that helps support their mission of feeding hungry people, as well as other ways to help the Middle Tennessee community. That's RockNashville.com. Good stuff there from Bob Herrick. Jamie Little will kick off the third hour. She was part of the broadcast yesterday on Fox as the race took place in Talladega, and it was quite the scene before the race, quite the scene. And we're going to get into all that and more with Jamie Little. Of course, still no new news on, I know, the local authorities, I know NASCAR, and even the FBI investigating the noose that was hanging in the stall in the garage area of Bubba Wallace. And Bubba Wallace, by the way, took the lead late, but exciting finish. Ryan Blaney gets the win. But we're going to get into all the stuff NASCAR with Jamie Little coming up at noon. I don't know, Willie, if you saw the scene, but wow, it was powerful.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, how could you not? It was a great response, no question. And as we were talking about yesterday, I hope they continue to use this as momentum to try to carry the whole system forward, right? That was an awesome moment that we're not going to forget anytime soon. But how does it turn into something really meaningful long term? It's not an easy answer, right? But that's it's a great start, a great response to something. And I was listening, I think it was Marty Smith that was talking about how it all came together in the drivers' meeting, how they started brainstorming.
Yes.
They wanted
yep.
to do something, mm-hmm. and they all sort of...
Jimmy Johnson was the first.
He started in there. Greg Biffle came in. You know, why don't we all push the car, all of these things.
Kevin Harvick.
Yeah.
Was a big part.
Yeah. Kevin Harvick. That's what I was thinking. I said Biffle, but it was Harvick that I think was instrumental in it as well, just based on what Marty Smith was saying. But all in all, you had this this really good visual that it transcended the NASCAR world, right? It got outside of the NASCAR world. It got into the CNN world. It got into the NBC, the CBS, the ABC. You know, everybody was showing that. And so that is what it's all about, right? That was huge to be able to do that and send a great message. But as we saw yesterday, I don't know if you saw this, but there was a lot of people that came out with the Confederate flags outside of the racetrack and tried to show their support or whatever you want to call it, right? So this is not going to go away anytime soon. There will be continued pushback, and so this is going to be a process to try to keep progressing. And I root for them to continue to do this. But here's another point, Darren, that was brought up yesterday on the Twitter sphere. God bless it, right? The good and the bad. But this was a good one, all right? You and Chase were bringing it up in early April, you know, when you were like, hey, you know, why couldn't NASCAR start before everybody else? Well, here's a moment that NASCAR has the full spotlight of the sports world. It's the leading thing on SportsCenter. It's the leading thing on anything that had to do with sports. And this is where baseball, again, on the day that they grudgingly are going to put this 60-game season together, apparently. You know, I'll believe it when I see it, I guess. I'm still not – I mean, would I be completely shocked if the players say, well, you know, we can't show up on July 1st, whatever. But baseball has missed the opportunity to have a moment like that, right, because of the squabbling. Has taken full advantage of it. They've turned a negative into a huge positive. And then they had a heck of a race, right? The race goes right down to the last second.
Yes.
And a guy finishing backwards finishes third.
Photo finish.
It's pretty
basically.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And they've benefited TV ratings wise. I mean, they have absolutely benefited from coming back. And yeah, when we first started talking about this, I said, I don't understand. I know you have crews that obviously jump over a wall for pit stops, but other than that, I don't know why NASCAR would not be out there first. I said that from the get-go, and I said that sport can absolutely use that and use this to their advantage. They've been going the wrong way with viewership on television, attendance. You know, when they, you know, 15 years ago, they were a rocket ship, and they've been going the wrong way for a good while. And lo and behold, they did figure it out. They were able to come back pretty quickly and come up with their return to racing. And they've been doing it effectively. And as you mentioned, they're getting a lot of pub right now. And it's really the first time I can think of in a long time where NASCAR has been kind of front and center the last week and a half, when it didn't involve an unfortunate death on the track or a really, really, really bad, horrific crash, right? Whether it's on one of the super speedways where a car goes up into the catch fence and, you know, into the stands, you know, just something horrific, something really, really bad. Now, I get it. There is some bad to this because of the story with the noose hanging. And, oh, by the way, they
also
found
one. Yeah, well, it's a reminder. It's a painful reminder of what image has been in the minds of a lot of people that haven't followed NASCAR, right? That's kind of the reputation. Well, you know, it's kind of the Southern thing. It's the white thing. It's, you know, there's a disconnect for a lot of people, but this is an opportunity to change that, right? So almost this was, again, as we talked about yesterday, the silver lining is you can turn this into an even stronger push to progress and try to be inclusive to more people, draw in new fans. And I thought they handled it really, really well.
Well, we talked to one of those, Bernard Pollard, last week, who said, you know, I am going to pay attention to this. And when you turn on Good Morning America or the Today Show, the big national platform shows right now, they are talking about the sport of NASCAR. They're getting a lot of attention. Some of it, or most of it, really good. Some of it not so good, talking about the tough topics. But because they decided to do something that's been a it's been out there for years about the Confederate flag. I don't even know how long it's been out there. And they actually did something about it. And Bubba Wallace and the attention and Black Lives Matter and all this stuff. And then the scene yesterday that we've already talked about, they are getting tons of attention. And the Marty Smith that you referenced, the interview where he was outside the Talladega Super Speedway, just doing what Marty Smith does, telling stories. And here's what you were referring to.
They have a driver chat, Scotty, where all of the guys are in a single chat room, and they typically discuss, oh, you wronged me here, or maybe we should unify together and go to NASCAR with this idea, that kind of thing. But Jimmy Johnson led the charge yet again, and in that driver chat, he said, I'm going to go stand beside Bubba during the national anthem. And one by one, everyone else started to fall in line and say, we need to do something bigger. And it was actually Kevin Harvick who had the idea that they should push the race car in unison to the front of the field, well beyond the other race cars at the end of pit road, and that they should all stand with Bubba for the national anthem. And Scotty, as I saw, not only the drivers pushed that race car down the pit lane during pre-race, gives me chills right now, down the pit lane during pre-race, but every single crew member fall in line and follow them in this gorgeous moment of solidarity. I love to see that Darrell was overwhelmed with emotion. He should be, because he's carried so much, so courageously. And when someone does what happened here on Sunday night and everyone stands with him and beside him and behind him and props him up in a moment like that, that's what NASCAR is about right now. And I am so proud. I'm proud today of what we saw.
If you were on Twitter during that yesterday, Twitter was blowing up in the middle of the afternoon. On that, it was. We always talk about things going viral. That video,
and a lot of non-NASCAR people.
Yes,
right.
Yes, no doubt. Those videos.
Here's the other thing that's
going viral.
Becoming apparent. Don't you think this has become apparent as well, Darren? And you guys probably had a better idea of this before I did. But the way Bubba Wallace is carrying himself through this is really noteworthy. He is a guy that you want to put out there. Right, he's done a very good job with this, and now he's been thrust into this even to a new level. So he can really be a catalyst for change, and he seems like the right guy. Would you agree?
I don't know if you know this. If you don't, I'll let you know. I do a pregame show for home games for the Predators in Barrel House. it's a really cool place there in Bridgestone Arena. I don't know if you've been in there or not. Tongue-in-cheek. I'm just kidding. But pregame, you know, sometimes there's themes to the night. This particular night
I know exactly where you're going.
Was setting up for Bristol. And there's been many times over the years where, you know, I've had Three Doors Down in there. I mean, you know, you name it. And so –
yeah, you get the first one I ever had. I got Al Michaels in that situation. Just people passing through. Or
good, you know, for you. I have not had Al Michaels in
but
there.
But you've had some pretty cool interviews just because of something that was being promoted or somebody passing through that was coming to a game. That's one of the coolest things about, you know, in that job.
Do you know who one of those interviews was?
I know where you're going. It was Bubba Wallace, wasn't it?
And I got to know, you know, I talked to him before the interview during the break. I talked to him after the interview, and this was several years ago. And right then I was like, wow, that guy's impressive. In fact, Willie, I think he may have been in the truck series when I did that interview. He wasn't in the Cup series.
Wow.
He may have been in the truck series, maybe. Xfinity, maybe. I'm thinking he was a truck driver. But right then I was like, this guy is impressive. I was really, really impressed. I mean, you just spend a couple of minutes with him, and he's easy to root for, very easy to root for. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I don't think I knew a whole lot about him going into that interview, but, boy, I certainly knew a whole lot about him after the interview, and he's been on my radar ever since.
So you agree with me that his
–
because obviously his profile has gone up about 1,000% since you interviewed him. It is cool. Like, we got to interview Jimmy Johnson in that same stage of his career before he blew up and became, you know, a multiple-time champion and all that stuff. It's interesting. But, you know, you could tell that night, in whatever year that was, 2000 or whatever, right when our – Super Speedway was opening up, and we got a chance to interview Jimmy Johnson. You could tell he had something, right? He had something, that personality. So that will serve Bubba Wallace well in this situation, and I hope that it leads to more and more good stuff. I heard, I don't usually watch these shows, but it happened to come on. I walked out of the room and came back. You know, I like to watch Get Up on ESPN from time to time, and it goes into the Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman deal, which it's not my style as much, but I heard Stephen A. Smith sort of make a challenge, right, and say, I want to see the response by NASCAR over the long term, right? This is nice, this is good, but I want to see you take it, you know, to the next step. Let's get more drivers. You know, that's a good challenge, I think. And it can't happen overnight. It's not going to happen this week. You know, let's celebrate the really good stuff, but let's also look at the big picture too.
No doubt about it. We will come back. Doug Clawson, something that we talked about at the end of the show. He's with ESPN Stats and Info yesterday. We ended the show with what Doug Clawson wrote about on ESPN.com. So we're going to get into that with him to close out hour number two of Darren, Donick, and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase on this Tuesday, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Yesterday we had a lot of fun in the final 30 minutes or so of the show, talking about an article that was written, and Doug Clawson is on the line with us, ESPN Stats and Info on ESPN.com, and it was a lot of fun. Like, we made sure not to look at it, and then Willie was going to ask us questions about how Doug, our next guest, ranked the 32 NFL teams from best to worst overall with quarterback play in the Super Bowl era. So, of course, since 1966, just breaking down, you know, the fortunes of some franchises and not so much for other franchises, and where did the Titans/Oilers and others rank. So, Doug, we really appreciated that article and had a lot of fun at the end of the show yesterday.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I was really excited and had a lot of fun researching this, and hopefully it sparked a lot of debate because there's definitely a lot of meat on the bone in this article. So what stuck out to you guys?
Well, I will say, and I'll get to that in a moment, let me just ask you where all this was hatched and kind of set up for our audience, you know, kind of the criteria, how you got 1 through 32.
Sure. Well, how this was hatched was NFL offseason, always trying to come up with compelling ideas to talk about. And one thing that's always interesting to me is, you know, what franchise has the longest drought without a real franchise quarterback? And, you know, who's had the most miserable quarterback experience? And I kind of had a tough time defining that, so I ended up jumping into, you know what, why don't we just rank all 32 teams top to bottom? It'll be a really fun exercise, and we'll see. It'll be really fun to see where all the teams land. So, you know, I tried to keep as simple as possible, and luckily there's a stat on profootballreference.com called approximate value. It's kind of like wins above replacement in baseball, and I was able to use that as the basis for, you know, finding out which teams had the best to worst overall quarterback production. And then, you know, I wanted to throw a few curveballs in there. So teams that really had great peak quarterback performance, I thought should kind of get a bonus. And then teams like your Cleveland Browns, who have had so many starting quarterbacks since 1999, I felt like they should be penalized. So that's kind of how these 1 through 32 rankings came to be.
Yeah, we went into our final break Doug and Willie said, okay, come back with your bottom five. And so think about it during the break and come back with your bottom five. And so I jotted down during the final break like my three no-brainers in my mind. The Browns, the Jets, and the Lions. And I said, I came, then I needed a fourth, and I said, I think I've got a wild card team here. I put the Bears on the list, and I also had the Arizona Cardinals. And so, like, I thought for sure, Browns, Lions, Jets, that's no-brainer. They've got to be at the bottom five. And I believe, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe Detroit was just above, right? I think they were like 26th or something, so I think I just missed it. And I couldn't believe it because usually the Lions historically are bad, and they haven't done a whole lot of meaningful winning, and there aren't a lot of franchise quarterbacks that I can really think of with the Lions over 50-plus years. So that was probably something that stood out to me. And then come to find out, the Bears, that I thought was kind of my wild card team, ended up being dead last.
Yeah, that's a good point on the Lions. You know, if you look at the teams with the longest drought without a franchise quarterback, I'm not even sure you would consider Stafford to be that guy just because of the postseason success. You might have to go all the way back to Bobby Lane in the 1950s. So I was a little bit surprised myself. I thought they would have gone a little lower in the rankings, and I think everyone's probably a little surprised that the Browns weren't last.
Right.
Just because how miserable their franchise has been. No offense to any Cleveland listeners on the line, but their quarterbacks have been the laughingstock of the league for a long time, even inspiring, obviously, all those lists of you know, the famous jerseys with all the lists of different quarterbacks. But one thing you didn't mention there was actually the Buccaneers.
Yeah, and I left them off.
Because they won a Super Bowl in 2002. A lot of people probably wouldn't expect them to be that low on that list. But remember, that was a team that was really dominated by defense. And we obviously did a lot of research on the Buccaneers when they got Tom Brady. And if you look at their quarterback history, it's really not good. I mean, you're talking their franchise passing leader is actually Jameis Winston, who they didn't even want to bring back on a fifth-year option. And then they have guys like Trent Dilfer, Doug Williams. But, I mean, it might surprise a lot of people that the Buccaneers have the worst record of any active franchise in all of the four major sports. So when you do a little more digging, it's actually surprising to see the Buccaneers landed second to last on this list, even worse than the Browns, which I thought was cool. And, yeah, here we go. We got Steve Young as the worst quarterback in Buccaneers history on that list, too, which just kind of boggles my mind.
I watched I was in the position in life. I was living in Orlando, and I was in that state. I got to watch a lot of Steve Young's terrible performances for the Buccaneers. It was really mind-boggling. They were so bad, and it was so crazy to think, you know, at the time that he was going to turn into a Hall of Famer. You never would have thought it.
Yeah, it's crazy how one team's trash is another team's treasure. And as a 49ers fan, I grew up, and one of the first times I became a fan of them was the Super Bowl against the Chargers when he threw for 6 touchdown passes. So I even learned a lot doing this. And just seeing how bad he was the Buccaneers, I was kind of shocked myself. So I'm sure a lot of that was the circumstances and, you know, the team he had built around him as well. Obviously a big disparity between Tampa and San Francisco, but that was – kind of funny how he ended up being the worst quarterback in the Buccaneers history and the best in the Niners history. And that kind of brings me another thought. That was probably the hardest choice was the best quarterback for the 49ers, Joe Montana versus Steve Young. So I was curious, did you guys talk about that yesterday and where did you land there?
Well, that was our big debate because both of us thought the 49ers would be number one. Like, we both agreed that the 49ers are going to be number one, and I think they were fifth, and, you know, we know that you had the Patriots. So we did question, not that the Patriots shouldn't be in the top five, but we felt pretty strongly that we thought the 49ers would be number one.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a case for them at number one, and I honestly, as a Niners fan too, thought they would be a little higher just because of obviously Joe Montana and Steve Young. I think maybe there's a little bit of a recency bias there, and just the fact that since, you know, Jeff Garcia in the early 2000s, you know, Alex Smith up until about 2011 was definitely an underperformer for them. Kaepernick's run was very short, which is obviously well documented, and they've had a lot of inconsistency since. And I believe they even started guys like Ken Dorsey, Chris Pickett, some strange names there in the 2000s. And maybe one of the reasons they kind of fell down the list was after Montana and Young, there's kind of a drop off there. Whereas I kind of mentioned at the top here, using this metric approximate value, Tom Brady was actually kind of worth two Hall of Fame quarterbacks in one. He was almost as valuable to the Patriots as Steve Young and Joe Montana were combined to the Niners, which is kind of mind-boggling in itself. And, you know, yeah, I'm probably crunching the numbers a little too hard here. And, hey, it's obviously not a perfect system, which is why it makes for, you know, great debates like this.
We're talking to Doug Clawson, put together a really comprehensive ranking of quarterback play by all the franchises in the Super Bowl era. You can see it on ESPN Plus and read it on ESPN Plus. We talked about it a lot yesterday on the show. And Doug, that is important for people that maybe didn't catch that. This is not just your opinion, you know, shooting from the hip. This is you rank them based on what your criteria had. So that is an interesting point on the 49ers. Is that the lower guys, when you have a poor performance for a long period of time, that does pull down the ranking, even though you have great guys at the top like Montana and Young.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned you guys thought that the 49ers were going to be first. I was pretty sure that the Packers were going to be first with Aaron Rodgers, Bart Starr, and Brett Favre, just because you could not possibly have a better Hall of Fame trio than those guys. But like you were mentioning with the 49ers, there has been kind of that long period where they really haven't had a great steady quarterback production. And for the Packers, between Bart Starr and Brett Favre, after doing some research, and if you just honestly look at the list of names from 72 to 91, they didn't really have anybody, and that's kind of why they weren't ranked number one. But definitely surprised when you have that trio that they were number one.
Well, another one that we talked about yesterday, Doug, was the Cowboys. And I wasn't surprised they were in the top five, and obviously Roger Staubach carries them. But one of the things that you noted that maybe puts something in perspective that's going on right now is that Dak Prescott actually has more Pro Bowl caliber seasons than Troy Aikman had in his entire career with the Cowboys. That's a pretty interesting stat.
Yeah, no, that's a good call, and I didn't actually even quite make that connection, so I think a lot of that has to do with the value that Dak Prescott adds with his legs that probably Troy Aikman didn't add. And that's something that approximate value would take into account on that pro football reference site. But maybe that's even a good fact that Prescott and his agent can use for a little negotiating tactics. But yeah, the Cowboys have had – the reason they're number four is just because the depth they've had at their quarterback position. There's six or seven guys there. Staubach, Tony Romo, Aikman, Danny White, Don Meredith in the 60s. They've just had so many solid quarterbacks for most of their history that's how they landed so high. And yeah, definitely surprising to see Prescott above Aikman in that category. Not saying he's better than Aikman, but obviously he's not, but certainly that stat is a little eye-popping.
Yeah, Danny White with three. Danny White probably underappreciated. They lost a couple of NFC championship games, but he was very, very good following up Roger Staubach. So that helps the Cowboys with the number one amount of Pro Bowl caliber seasons, which was one of your criteria. Let me ask you this, Doug. This is one we kicked around. The debate that you must have had, you know, with yourself, how did you go with Steve McNair over Warren Moon as the best in the Oilers/Titans franchise category?
Yeah, that was after Young and Montana. That was perhaps the second hardest debate for a best quarterback. Just because if you look at their tenures with the Oilers or Titans, very similar stats. So I guess while the team rankings were done by more of a criteria, I was subjective with who were the best quarterback and worst quarterback for each franchise. And you know what, there could have been a little bit of a recency bias since I kind of grew up getting into football in the 90s and 2000s when McNair was the guy. But he did have the co-MVP with Peyton Manning in 2003. He is the winningest quarterback in Titans history, And I think there's something to be said for the franchise going from Houston to Tennessee in those years, obviously being really critical as far as attracting a fan base and just how popular he was and his style of play and how tough he was. I think I might have given him a little bit of a bonus there. And, of course, he got them to the Super Bowl in 1999. And just digging through Warren Moon a lot, I don't think he made it to the NFC or AFC championship game even. So while the team rankings really didn't have anything to do with the accolades and the playoffs and stuff like that, the player rankings definitely did, and they had that subjective nature. So that's kind of why I went with Vic Nair. But I'm definitely curious, and I figured there'd be some debate here, especially from you all, where you stand on that one.
Yeah, we did not disagree, by the way. We both go with McNair and noted that, you know, Warren Moon is a Hall of Famer, but a lot of what he did was before and after he was actually with the franchise. And you pointed out, you know, the lack of playoff success for sure. Well, one more to hit you with, Doug, before we let you go. You know, that just we touched on it before. The Bears, you know, we don't think of them as a real unsuccessful franchise, or, you know, a folly franchise like maybe the Bucks or the Browns might come to mind before you think of the Bears, but dead last in quarterbacks. It is interesting when you really look at it, it makes a lot of sense. They just have not gotten good quarterback play, and it's been a shame because they've probably had some teams that had they had better quarterback play could have done a lot better.
Yeah, that was definitely interesting to me as well, because I thought, as many probably did, that the Browns were going to be last just because of how bad their franchise has been. But the defense of us obviously carried the Bears for a long time, and then obviously they had Walter Payton leading to a lot of success for that franchise. So the fact that they land 32 is like, whoa. But then you go through the list of quarterbacks, and just like Jay Cutler's their most productive quarterback in the Super Bowl era. Like Jim McMahon's the best quarterback, but even he wasn't around that long because of so much injuries. And just looking at, I think their most touchdown passes in the season was 29 by Eric Kramer. First of all, I don't even remember Eric Kramer was on the Bears, so I learned something there. But in this day and age where pretty much you have guys like Blake Bortles throwing for 35 touchdowns in the season, it's shocking to see just how little production they've had. And I don't think you can blame it all on the cold environment there in Chicago, but it'll definitely be interesting, too, to see how this kind of result plays itself out this year now with Nick Foles and Mitchell Trubisky. But there was a good article kind of attached to mine by ESPN Bears reporter Jeff Dickerson, kind of laying out too the, you know, the five or six reasons why the Bears have suffered at quarterback for so long. And they had one of the team historians break that down, which was really interesting too. So take a look at that too. If you're still second guessing, hey, how are the Bears the worst quarterback franchise?
Doug, we really appreciated the article. We had a lot of fun with it yesterday on the show, and we enjoyed having the discussion with you today. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah, I had a ton of fun looking into it and a ton of fun talking about it. So thank you. It was a pleasure being on. Thank you.
Sounds good. That is Doug Clawson, ESPN Stats and Info. And it was a really cool article, as you just heard us talk about, ranking 1 through 32 when it comes to NFL teams since the Super Bowl era began, and ranking their quarterback play. We will come back. Jamie Little, NASCAR on Fox. That's how we start the third hour of Darren Donick and Chase. That's next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.